One night, I found myself, as it were, out of the body, and in the presence of Amitabha, the Buddha of infinite light, who presides over the western quarter of the universe. The colour of the Buddha was a deep, rich, luminous red, like that of rubies, though at the same time soft and glowing, like the light of the setting sun. While his left hand rested on his lap, the fingers of his right hand held up by the stalk of a single red lotus, held up by the stalk a single red lotus in full bloom, and he sat in the usual cross-legged posture on an enormous red lotus that floated on the surface of the sea. To the left, immediately beneath the raised right arm of the Buddha, was the red hemisphere of the setting sun, its reflection glittering golden across the waters. How long the experience lasted, I do not know, for I seemed to be out of time, as well as out of the body. But I saw the Buddha as clearly as I had ever seen anything under the ordinary circumstances of my life. Indeed, far more clearly and vividly. The rich red colour of Amitabha himself, as well as of the two lotuses and the setting sun, made a particularly deep impression on me. It was more wonderful and more appealing than any earthly red. It was like red light, but so soft and at the same time so vivid as to be altogether without parallel. So this is Bhante as a young man in South India in the Virupaksha Guha. Virupaksha's cave on the side of Arunachala Mountain during his wandering days before he'd become a Buddhist monk, before he'd had his ordination. So he was staying near the ashram of Ramana Maharshi, and he has this vision. This vision he describes that after a paragraph describing a period with another great Indian teacher named Swami Ram Das. When he was staying with him, Bhante had this experience of a very, very high fever, a very, very high heat in his body. But he said his state was blissful and deeply calm. And Swami Ram Das said that it was a sign of purification. So perhaps the two go together, the vision of Amitabha and the earlier sense of or feeling or experience of purification. I think this talk perhaps is in the realm, if I'm not going to sound too grandiose, in the realm of Amitabha, because Amitabha has, certainly in Tantric Buddhism, all sorts of connections and resonances, one of which, of course, is craving. Amitabha represents the, according to Tantric Buddhism, the purification of craving, of Trishna, Lobha, Raga. And craving for me is a big problem, I have to say. I sometimes really don't feel suited to the Dharma life because I experience myself as someone of immense and habitual cravings. I'm not going to dwell on what they are, but some of my friends know them. But yes, craving. It's such an issue, really, isn't it? You know, there it is. It's the cause of our dukkha. It's when you attain nirvana, craving is pacified, is completely put out. I was talking to Sagramati this morning about nirvana as the extinguishing of the three fires of craving, hatred, and delusion. And I think sometimes that that maybe because craving is so central, it might be an area, and because we have it so strongly, so powerfully, I wonder if it's an area that we don't always engage with. Obviously, there's the sort of moral issues to do with craving, where we need to try and inhibit our cravings a lot more. I know I need to do a lot more inhibiting. But, of course, the Buddha's treatment of craving is much more than just moral. It's existential, isn't it? It's that drive that brings us back again and again and again to samsara. So I have to think much more in terms of the transformation of craving. So what I want to do in my talk, certainly in this talk, we'll see how it goes as we go along. I want to talk about the transformation of craving. Craving traditionally is divided into three: karma trishna, craving for sense experience; bhava trishna, craving for existence, becoming; and vibhava trishna, craving for non-existence. And I want to talk particularly about craving for sensual experience. What to do with it? What to do with craving for sensual experience? It's interesting that the word here is karma trishna, K long A-M-A, karma trishna. Karma, of course, is the god of love in Indian mythology. He's the Indian Eros. So a good place for me always to start, if I'm going to look at karma trishna, is the phenomena of falling in love. That's going to be my starting point. I don't know if any of you remember that particular experience. Some of us are getting a bit old for that probably now. But my memory of doing that, my memory, distant memories of intensely falling in love with someone is, you know, whether or not it's reciprocated, there's one particular quality about it that I've noticed, is just how intensely focused my consciousness is. Probably when I become infatuated with somebody, I'm more focused and concentrated than in any other experience, including meditation, etc. I'm absolutely fascinated by that person. I become extraordinarily resourceful about how I might get to know that person and so on and so forth. Everything is very heightened. Everything is very particular. So what I notice when I'm in love with somebody, that it's a very, very detailed awareness of the other person. Absolutely every detail. The eyebrows, the eyes, the lips, the way they move, the way they stand, their voice, the down on their face. Yes, absolutely everything is fascinating and utterly beautiful. There's something in craving for sense experience that is highly particular. Highly particular. It really is into the particulars. Even if you're not in love with somebody, that, you know, that habitual thing that you do, you know, the habitual things like the details of our breakfast. The toast has to be just so. The coffee or tea has to be brewed just right. If it's not like that, it can be catastrophic. You know, you see people really losing it sometimes in communities, you know, if the things that they particularly want aren't there. And I think it's this focused quality of desire for sense experience. It's in that, I think, that we can find the medicine for its transformation. It's in that highly focused quality of that intensity of craving that we can find the medicine. I've always been intrigued by Amitabha's jnana, Amitabha's awareness, Amitabha's particular knowledge, his particular wisdom, which is said to be the transformation of craving. It's usually translated as the wisdom of discrimination, but I think it would be better translated as the wisdom of particularity. The wisdom of particularity. By the way, I didn't know what Subhuti was going to be talking about this morning. I was very, very struck by his notice of his awareness of particulars. Amitabha is the symbol of the Buddha's vivid awareness of the minute particulars. Of the minute particulars, not just in one person, obviously, not just for one person, but for the unique and the particular everywhere, especially the unique and particular nature of each and every human being. It's said that when the Buddha spoke in an assembly, if the Buddha was speaking in an assembly such as this, his communication had a particular quality that every single person in that assembly would feel that the Buddha was talking to them personally, to their unique and particular experience, even though he was talking to people generally. So there is this quality of the Buddha's awareness that is highly particularized. But how can we possibly think of reaching that jnana? So I've got a few thoughts about how we can move in the direction of that jnana, of that enlightened awareness of particularity. And I want to start by talking about that, by talking about Shraddha. I want to talk about Shraddha, which is a lucid, bright, serene, pure and confident heart or mind, the Chetasa Prasada, the Shraddha that has that quality. And this is said to come, this quality of lucidity and luminosity of mind and serenity of mind is said to come when you lovingly contemplate the particular qualities of the three jewels of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. When you contemplate their particular qualities, the particular gunas of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And, it arises, I think, this sort of thing when you respond, particularly with me, is when you respond to stories of the Buddha. I can think in particular of, when I used to listen to Bhante telling stories about the Buddha, I think particularly of that lecture he gave at Padmaloka many years ago on a case of dysentery. I was there in the audience. And when Bhante talks about the Buddha, you actually feel you're there. And when he tells a story, it isn't somehow just the events of the story. He seems to kind of just say, with a few words, actually vividly evoke the scene and the way the Buddha actually responds to the particular person, the particular event. I regard Bhante as my sort of initiator into the life of the Buddha from that point of view. And you're given a sort of feeling knowledge, as it were, of a particular quality or a particular qualities of the Buddha. But we can take that a bit further, I think. We know how enraptured we can be by sensual forms. In the same way, we can become enraptured by the Buddha. Even in the Buddha's time, people became enraptured by his particular presence. Their experience of enlightenment, the beauty of enlightenment, was from this particular man. There was nothing abstract about it. I think on the last retreat that we did, I mentioned Vakali, this young man who fell in love with the Buddha. He just found the Buddha so amazingly beautiful that he just wanted to be with the Buddha all the time. So that the only way he could do that was by becoming a monk. He didn't want to become a monk, but he thought, well, if that's the only way I can be around the Buddha, I'll do that. The Buddha was so utterly beautiful. There's also the story of a Brahmin teacher who sends a disciple to really check the Buddha out, to see if he's got the 32 marks of a Mahapurusha. And what this particular disciple does, he sort of shadows the Buddha and just watching him, watching his body. But eventually he starts to see how he behaves, just what his day's like. He sees the Buddha's mindfulness, the way he walks, the way he sits, the way he communicates, what his voice is like, what the tones of his voice is like, the way he eats his food. He sees the Buddha's mindfulness entering into the minute particulars of life. And the way it's described in the sutta is that you just get this sense of the elegance of and the dignity of the Buddha's mindfulness, the way he lives. It's a deeply aesthetic experience as well as a spiritual experience for this young monk who actually ends up going for refuge and leaving his teacher. So lovingly gazing upon the Buddha becomes, in later tradition, a spiritual exercise. recollecting the Buddha, imagining the Buddha, it becomes an actual practice. You can see this reflected in liturgies, like in the Sutra of Golden Light, where you get those wonderful verses on the golden skin of the Buddha and all his really beautiful features. So it's clear that's become a spiritual practice. Was it? His shapely limbs are as pure gold, and his eyes are blue like sapphire, things like this. And this, over time, becomes extraordinarily sensual. One of the things that's very striking, if you read particularly in tantric sadhanas, the descriptions of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are really, really very heavily sensual. There's a verse that I can't remember it properly, by the great fifth Dalai Lama, where he's describing Tara, green Tara, in terms of, how does it go, the body of the goddess, sensuous, ravishing, like light shining on emeralds. And then there's the description of the glossy black plaits of her hair. It really is extraordinarily sensual. I mean, you were supposed to recite this in your meditation and really feel it, really experience it, even develop a loving fixation with that particular figure. It's not just with the female forms, it's with the male forms as well. I've found, you know, passages to do with Padmasambhava where it's highly sensual, the focus on, you know, the length of the eyes, the colour of the hair, the pinkness of the skin, the sensuality of the mouth. So it's yes, incredibly sensual. You know, this is what we're trying to do in sadhana. This is what we're trying to really replicate when we meditate on a Buddha or Bodhisattva. It's clear what's happening. That craving for sensual experience is being taken up, is being transformed through this different kind of imagined sensual experience in meditation. You're trying to take that quality of desire for sense experience into your inner life, into your internal life, into your spiritual life. I remember Bhante saying, when he was talking about, there's an answer to a question to do with why was metta bhavana so important as a preparation for sadhana, for visualization practice, and he was talking about metta reaching a stage of what he called formless beauty, and then the form of the Buddha or Bodhisattva sort of crystallizes out of that formless beauty, takes form before you. And he just made the point, he just said, beauty is incredibly important, especially in the early stages of visualization practice. The early stages seem to go on for a very long time, in my case. Incredibly important. It takes all your, the whole idea here is that the image, the form of Buddhahood takes all of your emotion, all of your desire, all of your fascination. Therefore, you are highly concentrated. And it comes down to dwelling on details. Now, Bhante, one detail that Bhante was very fond of talking about was the colour. In one lecture he was asked once, what are the effects of meditating regularly on green Tara, which was, of course, his root practice, the first initiation that he was given, and he practiced that sadhana every day for a number of years. And his reply was very interesting. He said, the effects of meditating on green Tara is the spiritual equivalent of greenness. The spiritual equivalent of greenness. There's something to do with greenness and reality, presumably. Though he didn't say that, I'm adding that. He just said that. I thought that was an incredibly wise reply. No concepts, no psychology, the spiritual equivalent of greenness. I went to see him a few years ago to ask him if I could take up the practice of a red dakini form, a sort of tantric form. And because I was having sort of impressions of red goddesses in my meditation. And, you know, Bansi said, yes, okay, you can do that. But then he just said, red goddesses. Red goddesses. And, you know, something's beginning to feel slightly uncomfortable. And then he just started to say, red. Red. As if to say, actually, Pramavadra, it's the red that's the really important detail here. It's the red. Yes, very interesting encounter with my teacher there. Traditionally, you go even further when you meditate on the details of the form. You know, when you meditate on a particular Buddha or Bodhisattva, you are supposed to really, you know, dwell on the details, but you're supposed to go even further, in the same way that the Brahmin is looking at the outward 32 marks and then actually sees the spiritual quality of the Buddha. The showing of the form of the Buddha or Bodhisattva is, of course, it's a showing of, I hate to use that word, reality, the showing of the mystery, the showing of the inconceivable beauty of Buddhahood. So, you know, as well as really gazing on the eyes or the locks or the colour or whatever it is, you're also instructed to see those as reflecting all the different dimensions of reality. Unfortunately, this can be worked out in the meditation manuals in a really sort of pat, off-putting way. I don't know if you've read that book, The Cult of Tara, but Jangun Kongtrul has this ravishing description of white Tara. I mean, totally ravishing. And then you get the explanation. Well, the two eyes symbolise the, and the two, and the other eyes this, and you feel rather put off. But you can see what they're getting at. The showing is actually opening up the mystery. All those different elements in the form, it's a kind of portal, a doorway, a gateway into this, yes, well, they call it the Dharmakaya, don't they? This mysterious, deep dimension. The sensual is the way into that. Where are we? So, yeah, so the beauty of the image, you know, when you really do encounter it, makes you gasp with wonder. It makes the rasa, the juice flows in you. You become kind of intoxicated by that. At the same time, you're being called to ponder the mystery much more deeply. This is, by the way, what the great Persian Sufi poets are really getting at in their poetry. So if you read a Sufi poem and you've got all these references to dwelling in the tavern of ruin and, you know, knocking back the wine which is brought to you by the beautiful Saki, the cup bearer, either a he or a her, and you're getting totally inebriated and completely fascinated with by the wondrous ecstatic eyes and the wondrous long locks of the wondrous wine worshipper, the wondrous mischievous sweetheart. It's not really to do with that. It's actually pointing and evoking something else. It is about that, but it's actually evoking something entirely different. It's a kind of, well, what's called a theophany, a showing of the divine, which you need to contemplate and move into. There's a lot to be said about that. But I think this kind of, you know, vision that we're trying to get at, I think when you live in this kind of awareness of the minute particulars, when you become sensitive to the minute particulars in the beautiful object, the beautiful Buddha form, the beautiful imagery, if you like, visionary beauty, it's not really happening in some other world. I think what starts to happen through this kind of engagement, you become more aware of and more sensitive to the beauty of the particulars everywhere, the beauty of the particulars all around you. It's interesting reading and rereading Bhante's time at Arunachala, where he has this great vision of Amitabha. This whole chapter isn't just remarkable, that whole book actually, The Thousand Petal Lotus, that's the form in which I first read it. It's not just remarkable for this effortless account of a vision. That emerges seamlessly out of Bhante's wider experience and his vivid awareness of the minute particulars of the world around him. You know, so, you know, as you read, you become aware as well of this the beautiful description of this vision. He also describes, you know, sharing this cave, he and Satchapriya, with this young ascetic, sort of almost naked ascetic, whose diet is entirely of chilies, and who has terrible flatulence problems. You know, he seems to be sort of farting all night, and Bhante is not so indecorous to use the word fart, but he describes pistol shots reverberating around this cave. You know, this is very close to this vision of Amitabha. He talks about, you know, the sound of the temple bell, you know, ringing in the cave somehow or other. Seems to have dreams of this temple bell clanging against him, reforming him, reforging him. It's like surf, great waves breaking in upon him. He describes the wonderful silence emanating from Ramana Maharshi. And there's a wonderful description of he and Satchapriya, you know, going for a wander and finding this world of these sort of tiny huts made out of wattle and daub. And they open the door of a hut and there's, Bhante says, the most beautiful young man he'd ever seen, sitting just in a loincloth, deep in meditation. Beautiful, Bhante said, not just on account of his fair complexion and his beautiful proportions, but because of the beatific smile on his face. He's just completely absorbed in samadhi, and Bhante describes silently closing the door and moving away. So it's not just about the beauty of an internal vision, you know, lovingly gazing upon the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I think if we're developing this vivid awareness of the minute particulars, it needs to come into every single area of our life, turning it, you know, from craving into this aesthetic, this vivid aesthetic awareness. I'm going to end, I'm sorry to say, with I'm not going to call it a poem because I wrote it. I'm not going to dignify it with that. But it does illustrate something to do with, if you like, the connection between, how can I call it, a transcendent beauty and the beauty all around one that needs to be found. And it came out of a very particular experience, in some ways quite an extreme experience. It was in the 1980s. And I was living in Bombay. I was brahmacharya, I was anagarika. It was very difficult living in Bombay. Bombay is a very dirty, noisy, in many ways very ugly city. I felt in many ways very alone, even though I had wonderful friends, Indian brothers and sisters. We were very inspired, doing a lot of Dharma work at that time. Almost every night we were doing Dharma work. Weekends, it was, you know, all throughout the day we were doing Dharma work. But I did find it very hard, you know, just the grubbiness and ugliness of living in Bombay. At that time, as well as being inspired by the Dharma, I was reading sort of old translations, particularly of Rumi. It was when I kind of discovered, you know, some of the early, more literal translations of Rumi and trying to get a feel for the Persian. And I had these, at various times, I had these sort of experiences, these epiphanies, I suppose, these aesthetic moments, where there seemed to be a kind of coming together of that, I don't know, call it transcendent beauty, and the actual details of my life, some of the things I saw. So these words came, and they came very, very quickly. They came just like that. You know, they just came up. I wrote them down. So I called it Rumi in Bombay. We have seen you, beloved, in the amber sun, climbing through the smog haze of morning. Seen you in a scarlet hibiscus, trembling by the railway. Seen you in swallows dancing in the pink air of evening, above crumbling ochre tenements. And we have seen you, at night, by an open sewer, in the wide jet eyes of the slum child, grubby hands folded in prayer. We have seen you, beloved. You make even this wilderness touch paradise.